Hello, welcome to another exciting episode of Forensic Forecast. Well, I say it's exciting. I think it's exciting. What about you, Simon?
Oh, it could potentially be exciting. We don't know yet. We haven't done it.
True, of course. first of all, we have to apologise for the last couple of weeks. Either we've been busy or we've had technical problems, or just, to be honest, I mean, last week I was just too tired to really do very much at all, and I took a week off work and etc. etc. But we're back. We're back again this week. And hopefully you'll find it enjoyable and interesting. And if, you know, Brandon, I know, has been on my back about getting a new episode up as soon as possible. So, yeah, here you go, Brandon. There's another one. I can't believe
it. Goodbye. not really. I thought that would be funny.
I can't believe it. We have fans. It's kind of weird. I feel like, well, I don't know, odd, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, it's especially strange when you think that we seem to be starting a trend of starting every podcast with an apology.
Well, it's only the last two. Three, four, no, I don't know. all right, well, how are you, Simon, anyway?
I'm doing well. I'm recovering from having the tooth pulled a few weeks ago now, so I'm doing all right.
Yes. Now you just have a little hole in your mouth.
Yeah. Well, but you learn to live with these things.
Yeah, well, you know, if you ever wanted to be involved in corporate espionage, you've got a decent little hidey hole in which to hide a secret microchip or something like that now, haven't you?
Yeah, it'd have to be pretty small. It's not that big a hole.
The fun. All right. Well, I think I think we have some things to talk about, don't we?
We do. There's been a bit of news since the last one.
Yep. And it's all very, very interesting stuff. First of all, I wanted to talk about this story first, just because I think people may have got the impression over the last few episodes that that we're not big fans, and especially me. I am not that big of a fan of this law, which requires forensic practitioners to be licensed private investigators.
Really? I don't know where people might have got the impression you don't like that.
Well, it was very subtle, Simon. Very, very subtle.
Like the whole subliminal message thing.
Yeah.
Just sneak it in there.
And so some people did pick up on that. But, yeah, there's finally some good news. The American Bar Association. Sorry, I don't know what it is. I've got a cold or something, so please excuse the sniffing. Hopefully it will be gone next week. Last week, the American Bar Association voted to support a resolution sponsored by the ABA Science and Technology section. Resolved that American Bar Association urges state, local and territorial legislatures, state regulatory agencies and other relevant government agencies or entities to refrain from requiring private investigator licenses for persons engaged in computer or digital forensic services or in the acquisition, review or analysis of digital or computer-based information, whether for purposes of obtaining or furnishing information for evidentiary or other purposes, or for providing expert testimony before a court. Yay!
It's not a victory yet, though, is it, really?
No, I know. But
then the American Bar Association generally have quite a say in things.
Well, they're a significant organisation, aren't they, in terms of the, you know, the whole legal process and whatnot. I read it and I thought, yeah, that's fantastic. And there's some people who have contrary views and say that maybe the ABA shouldn't be sticking their noses in where it's not welcome. Some people saying that maybe we should be regulated by something like this. I, for one, as people are well aware, do not believe that for a second and think the whole thing should be scrapped. Now, why do we think this has happened? Why do we think the ABA have come out and said this? I mean, this has no direct bearing on them, does it?
I can only imagine that someone's pointed this out to them, and they've and someone has decided that it's caused a lot more headaches than people might have thought it would have done in the first place.
Yeah, and that was my first thought as well. And I can just imagine seeing some lawyer somewhere. He's just picked up a new client who's willing to pay money and stuff, and this client has been accused of doing something illegal with his computer. And, you know, this the witness statement or the report or whatever else provided by the prosecuting expert has landed on this lawyer's desk. He looks at it and he thinks, all right, fair enough. We'll find someone who can write a report for our side and, you know, question some of the things in this report. Now, he goes out, and what does he find?
Sorry, were you asking me that question?
Oh, dear. Are you watching TV or something in the background?
No, I'm not, actually. I don't know what I was doing there for a second.
In all honesty, it was a good answer, because that's exactly what he would find, is absolutely nothing.
Well, there you go. How do you know I didn't do that intentionally?
But this lawyer would go out looking for someone to build a defence case, and in a lot of these states he would find it very, very difficult, wouldn't he?
I think he would.
It's just, I don't know, that's my own personal feeling about why they've got involved, because they've probably got all these lawyers have got an increasing number of computer cases which they have to try and defend, but they don't really have any hope of finding that many defence experts who are registered private investigators. And they don't want to turn the case over to just some PI who happens to have taken a couple of NCASE courses. I don't know. I mean, that's my opinion on why it's probably happened. I don't know. Take it for what it's worth.
You made an interesting... I mean, it's what I'm going to say probably sounds like it's way off topic, but trust me, it's going to come back round to being on topic. A few weeks ago, there was some talk about the cost of owning your own car and things in the UK going up, and you said, how about we test people at their word and everyone for a day stop using their cars and get on public transport? And let's just overload the system and prove that it can't handle the volume of people that would use it. So people have to use cars. So they're thereby testing people at their word. And I just wonder what would happen if people did the same things to PIs, if they actually took them at their word, and all of a sudden all these computer cases started showing up at PIs' offices. They'd have them coming out of their ears, and they wouldn't know what to do with them.
Well, yeah, I can see your point, but why would any lawyer, or in this country, solicitor or barrister, want to risk it? They'd want to go for somebody reputable, wouldn't they? That's the only way to have any kind of a real defence as well.
Well, I don't think it would ever get to a point of anything being done. I think if you just took a computer to a PI and said, I need this forensically examining for such and such, they would probably stare at you blankly and ask you to take it somewhere else. Certainly, I think that would happen over here.
And if you're living in a particularly small town, then you just say, well, I'm very sorry, you're the only private investigator around. I get your point, and I fully agree. Is that I don't think they'll be able to cope with the volume of work if they're really put under the pressure, because they can't just do the computer work either. Even if they know how to do the computer work, they will have other responsibilities to take care of, other cases. And for people involved in computer forensics, it's just not the case, is it? Because that's all you do all the time is just computer analysis. And nothing else gets in the way.
Yeah, that's true.
So, I don't know. I think it's fantastic, and people might argue and say that, you know, the ABA should keep out of it, and we should be regulated by PI licenses, but to be honest, I don't agree with that whatsoever. I think if we're going to be regulated, and I've said this before as well, that it needs to be peer regulation, really. It needs to be something like the IFSCE or the IFCSE. I don't even remember which way around it goes. But I should know, as I'm soon be taking my CCE. But someone like that needs to have, he needs to be the regulatory body for forensic practitioners and computer investigators, etc., etc. And I think that's the only way we can really hope to do it properly.
Yeah, I think we've probably, over the past few podcasts, maybe laboured this whole point of PI licences enough. I think it's maybe time to put the subject to bed a little bit, so as to not really bore the heck out of our listeners.
All right.
On to the next topic.
The next topic. Yeah, so, do RIAA snoops need PI licences?
Well, there you go. There's a fresh new topic.
Great. This appeared on the Wired website last week. And to be honest, I think this is, in a way, it's kind of peculiar, but in a way, I find it to be extremely funny. Not only am I not a big fan of people needing PI licenses, I'm also not a huge fan of the RIAA. Not because I download music illegally, because I don't. I just want to make that absolutely clear. I don't share music illegally or anything like that. But I just don't like the way that they work. We've seen cases over the last few years where the RIAA and their alleged experts have completely screwed up many, many different cases, even trying to prosecute people who are dead, who have long since moved from an address, or trying to sue somebody who's not actually a person, but is actually a printer.
Yeah, we hear all kinds of strange stories like this, don't we? We had one in the UK, actually, just in the past week or so, didn't we?
Go on.
It's probably not quite along the same lines. I'm not sure whether the RIA had any involvement in it, but probably not. It was to do with someone who was previously with a broadband company, who was never a user of file sharing software anyway. And then a good 6 months after he left his broadband company and moved to someone else, he got a letter from his original broadband company saying, you've been downloading such and such a thing. We have your IP address on record. At which point he was quite puzzled about the fact that they'd sent him a letter when his IP address had clearly been assigned to someone else.
Yeah, this was about television programs in the States, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
I mean, because what happens, for people who listen in the States, we usually get the TV shows and stuff that you get to see in, like, the fall lineup. We get them, you know, a couple of months after, probably, like, January or February, but they'll start over here. And so what people tend to do is that they download the episodes, you know, via BitTorrent or whatever other means they have. And that way they can keep up to date and don't have to wait for the TV shows to get released here. Just kind of jumping the gun a bit. Now, obviously, the TV networks aren't very happy about this. And in this particular case, this man, he was a... He was with the ISP, Tiscali, and 6 months previously he'd got completely fed up of Tiscali and said that he didn't want anything to do with them, so he left, went with another service provider. And like Simon says, he then got a letter 6 months later saying, you've been downloading this because it's your IP address. So you can't win, really, can you? It appears as if people who do this kind of work, like Media Sentry or SafeNet or whatever, the data they use seems to be completely out of date. But that's regardless. That's aside
I think
from...
that's yeah, that's aside from the main point, as I think you were probably just going to say, and it's going to be a factor of things. When they deal with so much data and so much information, they're going to make mistakes.
Yes. But going back to the Wired article, I mean, I just find this quite amusing, is that the RIAA, they've obviously employed Media Century to go on to all these different peer-to-peer networks and find out who the people are who are sharing these relevant files and stuff like that. But there's a handful of states now that have this law about the PI licenses, and this is the complete irony, because it's one thing I dislike, completely screwing over another thing I don't like, and it's almost, I don't know, it's almost justice to me.
It's almost like a balance in the world, isn't it, really?
But, yeah, so a few states, like, it lists Michigan, Texas, Florida, New York, Massachusetts, Oregon, and Arizona. It says that the RIAA's investigators have been told, I'm sorry, your evidence can't be submitted in any court case because you do not have a PI license for this state. Brilliant! I'm beginning to wonder if the person who came up with this PI license law was actually under investigation from the RIAA.
He's like, quick, let's introduce some kind of law that stops this evidence getting to court.
And instead of being a complete buffoon and coming up with a stupid law, has actually come up with something very, very clever and just given it the appearance of something very stupid.
I'd like to think whoever came up with the idea could be graced with that much intelligence to think that far ahead.
But, yeah, fantastic. It's really causing them quite a bit of trouble from the sounds of things as well. And I just find it completely amusing. When I read the story first off, I was laughing my head off. I just couldn't believe it.
But yeah, I think we need to make it clear that there should be one law for all, really, and it should be clear-cut what's going on with this whole PI license thing, because you've got different things going on.
Well, when it varies from state to state, it's going to be difficult, isn't it? Because let's say, I don't know exactly where Media Century are based, I don't know how many offices they have, but say that they were based in California and they came across an IP address of somewhere in Texas where we know this law is in place. What are they going to do about it? There's not really a lot they can do, is there?
No, well, they would have to essentially outsource it, wouldn't they?
To a private investigator.
Someone with a PI license.
Yeah.
And it just gets to the point where you're just doing too much with something. And these kind of cases will just fall over unless they get the law sorted out.
Yeah. I think the most likely scenario is that this PI law now has not just got opposition from the ABA, but we'll also see significant opposition from the RIAA and the MPAA.
Yep.
And with those three opposing it, you have to imagine that it's not going to be very long before some of these states start to crumble and say, all right, that's fair enough. We'll reverse the decision. Because otherwise, you know, you're going to have severe problems that are going to replicate this RIAA problem as time goes on.
Yeah, you're going to essentially have three big organisations that like to put pressure on legal systems to make decisions, all fighting against a bunch of these states, saying, "What are you doing this for? Stop it!" And I doubt anyone could handle that kind of pressure for very long.
No, but I mean, there is some good news for the RIAA, is that if they send out a letter to somebody and that, you know, and say, look, you pay this, so pay us this fine, or we're going to sue you, if those people then go away and wipe their computers and format them, then the judge is inclined to rule in the RIAA's favour.
Yeah, we've just had a case about that recently.
Yep. Atlantic and Howe. And in Arizona. Very, very amusing case, this. This guy, Jeffrey Howell, couldn't find a solicitor, a lawyer, sorry, to defend him, and decided he would defend himself Atlantic Records, I imagine, for sharing music over the Kazaa network. And he went away, obviously not knowing what really to do about it, and just formatted his hard drive and reinstalled everything. What was he thinking?
I guess he was thinking of covering his various activities, but at the same time, it's just a really stupid thing to do.
Well, in a way, right? I can kind of see what he's probably getting at here, and this is the question that I would ask, right? If that evidence no longer exists on his computer in a format which an expert can determine, then surely there is no evidence of him doing it on his computer, which means that he can't be proven guilty conclusively or beyond a reasonable doubt.
No, he can't really be proven guilty conclusively, you wouldn't have thought. So, it may seem like a stupid thing. It really just depends entirely on how the whole thing pans out. But
that would be my argument, because how can... Well, I guess that it's not really... It's not... I guess because it's a civil case, isn't it? It wasn't a criminal case. It was a civil case.
Yeah,
so they don't have to prove it beyond reasonable doubt. It only has to be...
Isn't it a balance of probabilities?
Yeah, balance of probability. So him formatting the hard drive would then be balance of probability that he was actually guilty doing it.
From the Atlantic side of things, they would have had some sort of record. They would have had records from Kazaa, or they would have had some sort of information relating to an IP address that related to this guy.
Yeah, I know, but having said that...
Obviously had just cause to send that letter out, but the fact that you stick that with the fact that he's just gone and formatted his computer after receiving this letter, and it does look pretty dodgy.
Yes. I mean, the judge said, defendant's intentional spoliation of computer evidence significantly prejudices plaintiff's, because it puts the most relevant evidence of their claim permanently beyond their reach. Oh, sorry, that was the RIAA. The deliberate destruction by itself compels the conclusion that such evidence supported the plaintiff's case. And the judge agreed and said, right, fine. He's one who has to pay up. And, the Electronic Frontier Foundation jumped in with their own little thing and said it wasn't fair because he couldn't afford his own attorney and whatnot. But the fact is, if you're going to do something stupid, really stupid, like that, then you're going to have one hell of an attorney to get you out of the sticky situation, aren't you?
Yeah, and you need a pretty good excuse as well, really.
Yeah.
It's probably possible he could have had something majorly wrong happen to his computer and he might have needed to format it or something. But...
Well, yeah, absolutely. But we've talked about this previously as well, and this is why I'm going to bring it up. By him doing that, not only has he eradicated any evidence which the RIAA would be looking for, but if he had a lawyer and a forensic expert on his side, he would have also eradicated any evidence that could have alleviated some of the pressure that could have you know, taken the overall cost of his case down. And
yeah, well, we were discussing this earlier on in the day, and I said that you're exactly right in saying that, because the RIAA or Atlantic or whoever could say, you had all of this on your computer that you downloaded and shared with people. And he could say, well, quite legitimately, well, actually, I didn't. I only had this amount on there. And the response to that would be, well, prove it.
Yeah.
And so he could have well just left himself open for a much more hefty fine, because he can't prove any degree of innocence because of what he's done.
No, absolutely.
But it just depends entirely on the way people see it. Some people might see that as, well, there's no evidence, therefore a decision can't really be made. But other people might say, look, he's gone and tried to get rid of things. That's evidence of guilt. It just depends entirely on the side you look at it from.
Yeah. No, I mean,
luckily for him, it was seen the other way.
I agree. But it annoys me, to be honest. I mean, if somebody's actually gone out and they've done something, then they've done it. I mean, there's no arguing either way. And yes, they're entitled to a fair trial, and yes, they're entitled to only be punished for the things that they've done. And I can understand that. And like you said, we don't know if there was anything wrong with his computer or anything at the time. He may have had a legitimate reason to do it, and we just don't know. But when the EFF go trouncing in and say, you know, it's not really fair because these people don't have enough money to defend themselves, well, maybe the EFF should just, I don't know, either not get involved or get completely involved. Either they want to help people to overcome these so-called bullying tactics from the RIAA, or they just need to keep their noses out altogether. It's no good going on and commenting and saying, you know, these guys can't afford lawyers to defend their cases. If they had, then, you know, they would have got off scot-free. Well, then why didn't the EFF provide some representation for him instead? I mean, the case isn't new. It's been going on for a while. I remember reading about this several months ago. So, I don't know. That's my opinion. Take it for what it's worth, I guess. But,
I'm just going to stay quiet with the whole worth of your opinion.
Oh, thank you. That means a lot. But yeah, don't, if you get a letter from the RIAA or the MPAA or the, you know, MMCPRFJ or whatever, just don't do anything. Just be sensible. Don't panic. And get somebody like us involved. Not necessarily us, but someone like us, probably with a bit more brains, in all honesty.
Speak for yourself.
I was.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Yeah, don't panic. Just find somebody who you can talk to about it. And it may not even cost anything just to talk to someone about it. And just see what options you have. Because there's no point in destroying evidence, because that just, it makes it so much worse.
Of course, the way to not get caught doing these things, as we've said before, is obvious. It's not to do them.
Well, yeah, but I can understand that, and I would really hope and pray that people aren't doing it. But if you've done it in the past and you've turned over a new leaf, for example, then there's still a possibility of that happening to you, isn't there?
Yeah.
So, anyway, like I said, my opinions are probably only worth the paper they're written on, and in fact, they're not even written on any paper. So that's. Anyway,
just transient.
Can you tell it's been a couple of weeks? Can you tell it's been a couple of weeks since we did an episode? We're about as cohesive as there you go, exactly. Right,
yeah, moving on.
So, since we last did a podcast episode, there has been movements in the hacker world.
There has. There's been the Black Hat, the security conference in Las Vegas.
Yep.
Which has produced some quite interesting results.
Oh yes, very much so.
I'm just scanning through a review of things from lore.com. And it points to a couple of issues such as DNS cache poisoning.
Which is a huge issue at the moment.
Yeah. I'm a little bit dense as far as it goes. I know what DNS is, and I know that this whole domain lookup thing translates words you type into a address bar on a web page into, or on a web browser, into an IP address where a website is actually stored.
Yes.
I know that much. I know there's a list stored on your own computer that's used to translate some things which you can alter and to your heart's content.
Yep, and your ISP will also probably maintain DNS servers.
Yeah, so I'm not personally sure how this fits into those other things.
All right, well, let's say, for example, that you visit PayPal. Okay, you've bought something on eBay and you visit PayPal. And you type paypal.com into your browser. It pops up the little lock down in the bottom corner saying that it's a secure web page.
Mm-hmm.
And you enter in all your details and everything, and then before you know it, all the money's gone out of your account, and you don't know why. This is one of the issues with DNS poisoning, is that you can create a website which will look exactly like the original, like PayPal, for example. You can then poison the DNS entries for PayPal on a server. Therefore, anyone trying to find out, trying to go to PayPal, will get redirected, so to speak, to this other server instead. But the PayPal certificate will still be valid, because as far as the certificate's concerned, it's still looking at paypal.com.
Hmm.
So it's a massive... PayPal use different techniques now anyway. They don't use the certificate method anymore. But that's just an example. There's plenty of sites which still do use certificates.
Yeah, it's quite scary when you think of the kind of implications of things like this.
Yeah, well, especially when you consider the online shopping market. I can't even remember what the figures are, but they're billions and billions and billions of pounds. And it even looks like it. Well, obviously with the credit crunch, it's a bit different. But before the credit crunch, it was looking as if online sales would actually outdo like physical in-store sales within the next few years. So it's a massive, massive problem.
And one that a lot of people aren't aware of, I guess, throughout the world. It's not something that I've ever seen on a TV news report or anything.
No, well,
obviously you don't want to cause mass panic with people.
No, well, and the last thing that anyone wants is people just to avoid buying things online. But the good news, if you could consider it good news, is that this wasn't at Black Hat, this was just before Black Hat started, is that buying things in a shop is just as secure, or even probably less secure, than buying things online, especially if you live in England.
Yeah, so basically don't buy anything anywhere.
So it's just, I don't know, it's a mess. Use cash.
Yeah, but where do you get the cash from? You get it from a cash machine, which someone might have altered to...
stop. Go into your bank.
You could get far too paranoid about everything.
Dear, oh dear. It could get worse.
Well, I think, generally speaking, as far as a lot of these things go, banks are well aware that these things go on, and they're pretty quick to restore people to where they were if they've been the victim of any such thing like this.
In this country? In this country, yes. But... in the States, your bank may not have an online online fraud protection, in which case you'd be, well, completely screwed. So, I don't know. But back to Black Hat. We're getting a bit sidetracked here. there's a couple of other different things that would be worth looking at. Unfortunately, the full... if you go onto blackhat.com, you can go and you can have a look at the archives and look at some of the items presented, with previous ones you've been able to download the video for some, the audio for some, the text for some, and then the slides. And most of them at the moment have only got the slides up. Some of them have got the text as well, but some of these. They'd look as if they need to be discussed whenever the full text is available, like passive and active leakage of secret data from non-networked computer. I mean, I don't know. I would assume it's going to talk probably about the wireless settings on your computer and how even if your computer's not connected to a wireless network, it could still be accessible and things like that. But there's loads of other stuff there. It's as a phone guru, Simon, you would be interested in knowing that the GSM stuff has now been hacked, which will basically allow people to intercept phone calls and the like from the GSM networks.
That's interesting.
So.
I think the problem with things like the Black Hat conference is you'd go along to it or even read up about it and you'd just be scared to leave your house or do anything by the time you're done.
There's also... Sorry, go on.
I was going to say, while they're obviously worthwhile doing and necessary for people to find out these things and look at improving security, it has the likelihood of creating some paranoid people.
Well, yeah. There's no doubt about that. And the most paranoid of all will probably be forensic investigators. I mean, one of the topics at Black Hat was mobile phone messaging anti-forensics, or whatever you want to call it. So, you know, with topics like that, you're going to really have some fun. There was one other one as well. I'm trying to think of what it was. Oh, yeah. Braving the cold, new methods for preventing cold boot attacks on encryption keys. And this is done by Patrick McGregor. And basically what he does is that he lays out, because I've read this one previously, he lays out a number of different things that you can do programmatically or in the hardware that would stop people from being able to recover the encryption keys. That we've talked about this previously, and that would be, you know, that could pose quite a significant problem for first responders, couldn't it?
Yeah, well, it's a relatively new thing being able to get around these kind of password issues. None of it's really a perfect science. There's always holes in operating systems, and as soon as they're found, they're plugged up and all these kind of things. So while one method of doing things goes, usually another one surfaces before too long.
Yeah, well, that's the whole thing, isn't it, as well? Is that Black Hat, it's cool because it comes out and it says, look, there's all these problems and stuff. But you know, they tend to get fixed, don't they? The problems tend to get fixed pretty quickly. And in cases where it might be considered anti-forensics, they'll come up with this anti-forensic methodology, and then, you know, a couple months down the line, some forensic investigator who's done some research and found something else which will allow us to retrieve the data, and then Black Hat will come back again, or some hacker will come back again and say, no, actually, now we've counted that. And it's like a game of chess. It's just move, counter move, move and counter move. And it's just, you know, it's a never ending game of chess, really. And that really would be dull.
I think I've played one or two of those.
Speaking of which, it's your move. all right, so I don't think there's anything else particularly at Black Hat, was there? Unless you saw something else?
Not that I can think of.
Fair enough. There was one other thing. I mean, there was a presentation done that was called Meet the Owner of a Real Hacked Company Forensic Investigation. And it talks about the different things that they did in order to investigate what happened to this company and how they determined what had happened. And the slides are up for that. And as soon as any of the other stuff comes up, it will really be worth having a more in-depth look at. I want to go to Black Hat. I'm not going to hide that fact. I'd love to go. Rather than sit here and imagine what the talks were about, I would actually like to have been there and just say, oh, yeah, you know. I went to this talk and they talked about this and I didn't understand a thing they were saying. But at least I was there.
Yeah, exactly. people could say that to potentially a lot of things to go to, couldn't they, really? And I didn't understand a word of it, but at least I was there. But I thought one of the other things that was quite interesting was talking about cross-site scripting for social networking.
Oh, dear.
And how the introduction of these, what kind of introduce advanced features to users at the same time, make it possible to hack into social networking sites and add yourself to friends lists and impersonate other people and lock other people's accounts and all sorts of things.
Fantastic.
I think the good news for that is that...
Well, in all fairness, most people who go onto social networks should have their accounts taken off.
Yeah, well, I use a social networking site, but I don't use it very much, and I wouldn't be at all bothered, really, if it just kind of disappeared and people had to contact me by email again, because people just don't seem to do that anymore. But obviously they're useful, but they're not the be-all and end-all. And so if things go wrong and they become something that aren't safe to use, then I'm not that bothered. I don't have anything particularly important on mine.
Nah. But so, for some people, it's their life, though, isn't it? And they post absolutely everything on there. So you can kind of... Yeah. You can understand people being a little bit panicked by this. But... You know, yeah, but to you and me, it's not the be-all and end-all. I could survive quite happily without Facebook. I survived quite happily without MySpace when it was going, so... Yeah.
What do you mean when it was going? It's still going. People just forget it's there.
Well, it's not really, is it? It's dying. It's not as good as Facebook.
Well, actually, someone did a kind of survey on it, didn't they, and discovered that while a lot of surveys in the past have said that MySpace was still top, that as far as user accounts that were actually being used, it's fallen way behind Facebook now.
Because back in the day, everyone set up a MySpace account, and no doubt Facebook will go the same way eventually when the next big thing comes along. But people signed up for it and like, hey, look at this, I'm on MySpace. And then,
I think the thing is that there's a lot of things that there's even a lot of websites now for different things that just decide to include a social networking portion to it.
Yeah.
For movie reviews, for sharing pictures, for anything you can think of, there's some kind of social networking group you can join for it. Yeah. And MySpace still has its uses. There's still a lot of like music groups and things that use it, but most normal people use Facebook and things like that now, and have kind of migrated from one to the other. And in the next year or two, may well migrate to something else.
Yep, the Forensic Forecast social networking page. Oh, dear. All right, well, we'll put an end to talking about that now. Have you got an interesting story for us this week, Simon?
I do. A story from, I think it was last week I read this, and I really thought it was highly amusing. I forget what newspaper it was reported in, but it's shown up on a couple of places online. It's shown up on The Register, I think. It's about a guy who it was a Lloyds TSB customer. That's one of the main banks in the UK. And he had previously had holiday insurance with them had a skiing accident, and they decided he wasn't covered and left him with a bill for injuries that was over £1,000. And so he didn't much like Lloyds TSB after that. So he got home, and he rather than just ditch Lloyds altogether, he stayed with them, and he changed his password on his telephone and internet banking. And he changed his password to Lloyds is pants.
Which basically means Lloyds is crap, yeah?
Yeah. One thing you have to realise about the British is they have probably about 300 or so words for calling something useless. Whereas I don't think anyone else in the world has the same kind of vocabulary for that. Yeah, basically, Lloyds are no good, Lloyds are useless, that kind of thing. And he set his password up as that. He had been using it for 2 years for phone and online banking. And then one day he called up to do a transaction. He said what his password was. He previously called up a few times, and he said usually every time he called up and said his password, he would at least get a laugh out of the call centre staff. But he called up this one time, and they said, I'm sorry, that's not your password. And he discovered that the password had been changed from Lloyds is pants to No, we are not. And some staff member had taken offence to it and decided to change it for him. And he's discovered since that that they've decided to incorporate some sort of censoring on passwords. He asked for it to be reset to Lloyds is rubbish. That was turned down. He tried Barclays is better. That was turned down. And was trying different things. And I think his, the final password he went with, I'm assuming he doesn't use it now, as this was reported in a national newspaper, he finally went with feces. But he said what was it he said? He was called Steve Jetley. And his comment was, I haven't registered a new... that was accepted as a password, but he obviously didn't use it. He said, I haven't registered a new password yet. I'm still trying to think of one I can get past the censors.
And his account number is 417...
Well, they give you all sorts of other information about him. They tell you his name, his age, where he lives. So, well, there you go. Any identity thieves listening, it's probably a slightly easier target there.
Although probably not so, because every other identity thief in the world has probably had a go at him already.
Well, yeah, probably. And by now he probably doesn't bank with Lloyds TSB anymore anyway.
He'd probably be very annoyed at Lloyds if he came to use his account one day and there was no money left in it. Oh, well, you know, we're sorry, sir, but you did go to the newspapers, and so that was to be expected. Sorry. Go to Barclays, you obviously think they're better. But, yeah. Oh, dear.
The other password they wouldn't let him use was censorship.
Great stuff. Oh, that's fantastic.
I just thought that was a highly amusing story. And you can just imagine the guy just being really confused when someone had changed his password for him.
I think that person has since been sacked as well, haven't they, by the bank?
More than likely. I think they should be, in all honesty, because that's something that was out of what they should have been doing. So
yeah. I'm quite surprised that someone was able to go in and change his password like that anyway without any real permission.
It raises all sorts of issues about privacy and about security and that kind of thing, and you'd assume that the password you have stored is, with anyone, is quite safe, and it's up to you to alter it.
Well, that's the whole idea of having a password in the first place, isn't it? You want it to be secure. You don't want it to be available to just for anyone to go in and see what it is or to change it.
Well, the thing is, you can think about it from another point of view as well, from a more cynical point of view. If that member of staff decided to go that far, he could easily have changed the password. He obviously had access to this person's details, if he could do that. And he could have easily done this identity theft lark himself.
Yeah.
So,
I don't know how it works for you, but if I log in online to my bank account, it asks for, randomly asks for two different characters out of my password. So it'll say, going to have the third and the 142nd letter of your password, please.
Yeah.
I don't really have a password of 142 characters, but... Yeah, anyway.
It's actually just 141.
I'm not that big of a geek. No, it's only 130. I don't know why they needed to know what his entire password was anyway. That just seems odd.
To me, that's made me a lot more wary about using passwords for anything, really, and the fact that people might be able to actually get access to them, and, getting access to them is one thing, but possibly even being able to change them to something else. And
yeah, but especially if you use the same password for everything as well.
Yeah.
I mean, if you've got accounts, online or telecommunications accounts or whatever, almost all of them require some kind of password in order to get in and make adjustments to your account. And if you, I was going to say lazy, but if you don't think about it properly, you probably are going to use the same password for all of them, and it's probably something very easy to get around. So people just need to bear that in mind in future, don't they, when setting up accounts. Don't use the same password for everything, and try and make the password quite difficult to guess as well.
It's difficult though, isn't it? Because you try and use a different password for everything, and before you know it, you've forgotten what all your passwords were, and you've locked yourself out of everything.
Yeah, well, I had that problem yesterday. I was on GoDaddy setting up a new domain name for my wife. And I was trying to log into my GoDaddy account, and I knew what my login identity was. I didn't know what the password was, and so it said, "Oh, it click here to get the hint." So I clicked on it for the hint, and the hint just came back, and it said, "Guess." And I'm like, I knew I should have put something better in than that. So I tried about three different passwords, and thankfully the third one worked.
Yeah, I think a lot of people who have...
I need to give myself a lot better clues than some cryptic nonsense like that, don't I? Otherwise I end up kicking myself in the future again.
Yeah, I think we've all been there at some point in time and forgotten a password and got really frustrated when we've locked ourselves out of something. But the good news is that most things, there's a way to reset it or something else. In a way that only you can access.
But oh yeah, absolutely.
The whole password thing—it's all quite amusing.
Yep. All right, I think we've exhausted all the amusing topics of conversation for today. So, I think we'll call it a day there. Thanks for listening. And thank you, Simon, for joining me again.
Yeah, you're welcome.
And we will talk to everyone again very soon. Goodbye.
Bye.